The following podcast is offered freely through the Insight Meditation Community of Washington and by Jonathan Faust. To learn more or to make a donation to support this work, please go to www.jonathanfaust.com. So we've been exploring this acronym of RAIN, R-A-I-N, quite a bit. And another acronym came to mind, which I wanted to share with you, and it's drag. That is, as you're meditating, the first is, if something unpleasant is arising, first to deny it as best you can. If you find it to be persistent, you can move on to the R, which is to reject it with everything you have. And then just do everything you can to avoid it, the A, and the G, go anywhere but there. So. Keep that in mind as a backup. So we've explored a lot in the Dharma talks of working with the difficult energies as they arise and exploring our relationship to them, working with the body and the three characteristics of change, relationship to change, and not self. Developing self-compassion as a part, an integral part of the practice. And last night, Trudy's wonderful talk on skillful means. What we've really explored is how to sharpen your awareness of what's happening while it's happening, a real-time awareness. But also how to sharpen your attention to your relationship to what's happening, the attitude in the mind, how you're holding your experience. And believe it or not, you have been developing wisdom, which is the capacity to recognize and name what's true. And you've been developing compassion, loving presence, the capacity to be with what's there, to hold your experience with empathy and with kindness. What I'd like to talk about tonight, this awareness thing, you know, what is it? How do we rest our attention in awareness itself? So I'd like to talk a little bit about the process of our practice, which is about arriving in the here and now and developing our capacity to observe the here and now. A little bit about the optimal conditions that support us in the practice. And then to explore some of how is it that we can rest in awareness itself. And as we train ourselves in resting in presence, how does that grow? How does that flower? How do we live in the world with that as an essential part of our intention? So an important part of this training that we've been going through is about arriving, gathering our attention in the here and now. There's a wonderful analogy that I found helpful. If you've ever seen people who are dyeing cloth in indigo, you know, that brilliant blue indigo. When they start, they take white cloth and they dip it into the indigo. They pull it out of the dye and it's this brilliant blue. And they hang it up to dry. And as it dries, it goes almost back to white. Just the slightest little tinge of the blue dye remains. And so after it's dry, they again take the dye, they take the cloth, they dip it, saturate it into the dye. They take it out, they hang it up to dry. As it dries, it again goes toward white, but not quite as white as before. A little bit more of the dye adheres to the fabric. And with successive dippings, the fabric begins to take on the dye itself. Can you sense how this may be true in your practice this week? Perhaps how much more quickly, when you close your eyes, your awareness goes right inside? Maybe you're slightly more inclined to hold your experience with some empathy, with some kindness. Maybe you've noticed your NPMs increasing, your noticings per minute. And you've also been rewiring your nervous system. There's that wonderful line that says that the neurons that fire together wire together. When you have a stimulus and the same response, again and again and again, that wiring becomes pretty solid. The word samsara, literally, or samskara, means groove. These are the grooves we fall into, the habits we fall into. And now with functional MRIs, we can see what happens in the brain. Stimulus, a response, the same response. When you encounter a familiar belief, when you encounter a habitual way of reacting to your experience, perhaps you have now seen it in a different way. Rather than a reaction of contraction or aversion or disassociation, maybe you're a little more present to it. And when you do that, you are literally rewiring your brain. Your nervous system is rearranging itself. This practice is a disruption to all of our habitual ways of moving through life. By practicing these observances and restraints, we are now seeing more clearly how we react to stimulus. And how you react in meditation most probably is exactly how you react to that same stimulation out in the real world. But here you get to slow it down. Chances are really good that you have also increased gray matter concentration in the left hippocampus, if you didn't know that. Also the posterior cingulate cortex, the temporoparietal junction, and the cerebellum. These are the brain regions that are involved in learning and memory, emotional regulation, sense of self, and perspective. And what's so fascinating with all the science being done is we know subjectively that something happens in this practice. There's some settling. There's a little more gap between stimulus and response, and now we can see that. We can measure it in the brain. It's an amazing time. So this gathering, this arriving, is a function of our meditation practice. There is a willful quality of practice. You come back. You inhabit. You relax. You arrive. And we do this again and again and again. Annapola Gunaratana says, mindfulness is present time awareness. It takes place in the here and now. It is the observance of what is happening right now in the present moment. It stays forever in the present, perpetually on the crest of the ongoing waves of passing time. If you are remembering your second grade teacher, that is memory. When you then become aware that you are remembering your second grade teacher, that is mindfulness. If you then conceptualize the process and say to yourself, oh, I am remembering, that is thinking. So to set the stage for our practice, we have created certain conditions. You may know that line, that enlightenment is an accident. And meditation makes you accident prone. So we have created an optimal environment for this training. And we need this support, of course. Ramana Maharshi described the mind as a drunken monkey stung by scorpions. It takes an extraordinary effort to come in real relationship with that mind. So some of how we have set the conditions for ourselves. We have explored sila, our moral behavior, the precepts, the restraints of where we have agreed where we're not going to go so we can stay inside the riverbanks. We can incline the mind toward gratitude, as Pat has talked about, which invokes a quality of receptivity. We can tune into that framework of the practice of remembering awareness, truth, and love of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. We remember in our practice these five energies, that when these five mental factors are present, we start to identify with those energies and we get lost, we get hijacked by them, by the different flavors of aversion, of wanting, of craving, of worry and restlessness, sloth and torpor, of doubt, being paralyzed by self-criticism. We remember that when we can name those weather systems, we shift our relationship to our experience. We remember again and again the framework of the three characteristics, that our experience is filled with change. How we relate to that change has direct impact on stress, suffering, and dissatisfaction. That nothing that arises or falls is you, this quality of not self, which we'll talk about a little more tonight. We remember that compassion and kindness is a powerful force. That when we call on compassion and kindness, it helps to release the binds. And we remember the middle way, not too tight, not too loose. We become more sensitive to when we're too wound up, leaning too hard, and we soften a little bit. And when we're scattered, bring a little more focus in to open up that space of presence. And we remember from time to time that when our personal demons come to visit, to have tea, to pause and investigate. The word sati, as Trudy said last night, is about remembering. So much of our practice is about remembering, this calling back to here and now. So there is a willful quality to practice. There's also this quality of taking the seat of the observer, opening to the flow of the inner and the outer experience as a sense of a non-judging observer. We develop more of a sense of foreground and background, holding an anchor in the foreground. And as we relax and open our attention, becoming aware of everything that's changing. And inevitably in this practice, there's a question that emerges at some point, which is, who am I? Truly. Not Trudy, she's over there, truly. In this realm of conditioned experience that I'm getting to know better and better and better, what is unconditioned? What doesn't change? What is it that doesn't get old, sick, and die? And how do we turn our attention to awareness itself, to presence itself? There's a particular analogy, a classic analogy, which can be very, very helpful. It has for me. To kind of preface this, I was sharing in our group this afternoon how when I'm doing interviews on a retreat, there's one sharing I really don't want to hear, and that's when someone says, there's this song that's been going through my head for 3 days. It goes like this. I do not want that virus. I love Trudy's recounting of Groundhog Day, you know, the classic Dharma movie of all times. I want to talk about a movie and the principle, something about movies here. And I'm not going to tell you the title of this movie because I do not want to infect you. You could call this movie a psychological thriller. When I saw this, I was living in an ashram. I had a poverty vow, a celibacy vow. I was reading only scripture, you know, for many, many years. And I was presenting at a conference in New York City. I went in with one of the brothers, and we had some free time, so we thought, well, let's go to a movie. So we went to this movie, and it was so full that we had to sit in different seats. So I'm in this big city, sitting by myself. And in the ashram, the only movies we would watch were movies that had no violence and no sex. So we just watched Disney movies. But we got really racy because we watched Pee Wee Herman one time, and that was way out there. This movie was really disturbed. And I was terrified. It was like a psychological, it was just so twisted, really, really twisted. And at some point, I wanted to leave, but it was New York City, and I didn't know where my friend was, and you know, and all this stuff was going on. I was so caught in the movie that at one point, I'm really not making this up, I said to myself, this is a movie, these are actors, there are cameras, there are people standing offset with water when the cut is over to give the water to them. It was everything I could do to remind myself it was a movie because I was so caught in this sort of like tortured psychological stuff. It's a lot like meditation. There's a movie playing. And when you watch a movie, most movies are 24 frames per second. So there's still images that move through at 24 frames per second, which is faster than the mind can compute. So it looks like fluid movement. And we experience it as real. Part of it is we go into, as Coleridge said, the willing suspension of disbelief. Oftentimes we go to a movie, but we get sucked into the movie. I love that definition of entertainment, that entertainment is paying someone to run your mind. You know. So we do that. We pay for entertainment. But when we are practicing meditation, we're witness to our own personal movie. We become entranced by the movie. You think it's real. You get lost in the drama. And every now and then, you remember it's a movie. And meditation is all about watching the movie and watching the unfolding and noticing how you're relating to the movie. But here's the really interesting stuff where it gets kind of trippy. Just as if you're in a movie theater, watching the movie, you can see the image on the screen, but you can also turn your attention back to the projector. And you can look at the film passing through, and beyond the film, there's the light, this powerful light bulb that's shining. In that same way, it's possible when you are watching the movie of your life to pause and turn your attention back toward the source. Pat Pat used the language in leading meditation the other day as he was guiding the meditation on awareness of thought, of to notice the contours of thought, how some thoughts maybe have more of an auditory quality, some may have more of a visual quality, and many, of course, have a kinesthetic quality as well. But that's part of recognizing the movie. But the question is, how do we turn our attention to the source itself? How do we awaken to, for lack of better words, our true nature? So what I'm going to launch into is the most delicate of practices. I have spent hours and hours in deep, deep frustration with some of the techniques that help to guide our attention back towards source. Because it is a practice of moving from conceptual to non-conceptual. I'll share one with you. One of the practices that helps to guide our attention back is the practice of inquiry. You ask a question and you track where that question takes you. I'll talk a little bit more about it. But just as we did in our practice, if you were here before this talk, you ask a question, can you feel or imagine the space between your forehead and the back of your head? It directs your attention toward an experience. And there can be sort of like a cumulative effect of that sense of opening to space and that inquiry into effortlessness. So I did a program that was one of the most brutal retreats I've ever done in my life, and I can't believe I did it 3 times. 18 hours a day for 3 days. One question. Tell me who you are. You do it in dyads. 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes, break. 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes, lunch. As the question came to me in the beginning of the retreat, you know, your partner asked, please tell me who you are. And the practice is you take the question and as sincerely as you can, you let it drop in. You relax into the question. And then you articulate what arises. So, of course, I began with, you know, I'm a male and, you know, I grew up in Pennsylvania and I was raised a Quaker and kind of my life story. So I kind of got that out. And then a question, please tell me who you are. Well, what now? What I noticed pretty quickly was how bored I became with my story. But that didn't begin to compare to how bored I became with everyone else I was listening to. I'll talk in a few moments part of the conditions that are helpful when we kind of move into this kind of inquiry that takes us into sort of a non-conceptual experience of presence. But what I found over the course of those grueling retreats was very much like dyeing the cloth in indigo. That the more I would immerse into the inquiry, into the question, the story began to drop away. And I began to recognize that anything conceptual I could come up with was not it. It actually would take me at times to an experience that was beyond words. So just as we can set the stage for inquiry into concentration and mindfulness, you know, we can reflect on some of the conditions for inquiry. And there are really three that I think are helpful. They actually kind of apply for both. But one of them is sincerity. Like a sincere desire to know the self, to know that space. Another is a willingness to stay one-pointed and on point. There are many different techniques that you can employ. But when you select a technique to give yourself to it fully, to start again, just as we do in concentration practice. And a third quality is courage. The willingness to move into spaces that may feel uncomfortable or maybe disorienting. So sincerity, willingness to stay one-pointed and courage. So we can train our attention. Attention is like light. If you think it as light, you can take light and narrow it down and run it through a magnifying glass and burn a hole in a leaf. You can also open up into diffused light, just standing in the light outside. And the light is everywhere. There's no effort. There's just a quality of being in the light. And we have the skillful means that can help to train us for narrow focus. And then it can also train us into the inquiry into open focus. As we did in that meditation to sense the space, to ask, is it possible that this perception of space is effortless? And to simply track the experience that arises from that question. Creating a more open focus can change our perspective. One of my good friends was a psychotherapist, and when I was living in the ashram, I'd visit her on Martha's Vineyard quite often. And in her therapy room, where the client would sit, right across from them, she had a poster of the Earth from the moon. And quite often, when someone was really gnarly, she would just have them look at that poster as a way to kind of help them reframe their struggles. Trogyam Rinpoche was the founder of the Ropa Institute, the classic story. He walked into a classroom and there was an easel, and he put a little V on the easel and he said, "What is this?" And someone raised their hand and said, "That's a bird." He said, "No, it's the sky with a bird flying through it." There's a poet who talks about the importance of occasionally taking the 3,000-year view. I love that. It just opens up the frame. Anytime we reflect on sickness, old age, and death, it opens up the frame from a narrow to a more open focus. So just as there are many practices that help us to develop concentration, help us develop mindfulness or non-judging awareness, there are different traditions and techniques that can help you turn your attention to the formless. These practices that help you move from a conceptual mind to more of a non-conceptual experience. And so just some of them. I wanted to share just a little bit, and then we'll have some experience. We'll just sort of try these on, and I'll talk a little bit about what can occur when we immerse ourselves in that dye again and again and again in this perspective of open awareness. Probably one of the most classic teachers and teachings is Ramana Maharshi. And just very briefly, when he was 17, an uncle who was very, very close to died suddenly. It was such a shock to him. And that one day, 17 years old, he left school early and he just lay down on his sleeping mat. And he tried to connect with his uncle and just reflect on what happens when you die. And he experienced a profound shift in consciousness that was part of his awakening. And he developed self-inquiry meditation. And what he said was that you can realize your true nature by living into two fundamental questions. The first one is, who am I? The second is, what do I really, really want? that technique, which we'll talk about in a little bit, is quite profound. Because just as I had to respond to tell me who you are, it began to strip away the story. You end up with something that's kind of at the very center of the onion as you peel those layers back. The technique of koans. What was your face before you were born? That is a technique, a tradition and a technique, where you take that inquiry and you deeply, sincerely reflect on it. And it takes you not to a concept where you get the answer, but to deliver you to an experience. And it requires rigor, and it requires sincerity, and it requires courage. The master Dogen said, take the backward step that turns the light and shines it inward. When we ask ourselves, who am I? With a sense of sincerity, we're turning our light, we're turning our awareness inward. We're turning our attention to the light behind the film. We can direct our attention to space, to be the space in which thoughts, feelings, moods, sensations are clouds and weather systems passing through, to have that be our anchor, that spaciousness. As we open to the aliveness of form through sound, we can turn our attention to the silence that holds the sounds. So I'd like to explore with you a few of these practices, just simply to try them on. And I thought what I might do would be to kind of share a practice, maybe share a little reading, a little commentary, and we'll sort of move in and out of this space. So if you like, you can close your eyes. You might take a few moments to sense what might soften or relax. Sensing through not just the body, but the mind itself. Is there anything that might soften or relax right now? Is there anything that might soften or relax even more than that? And you might take this time to let your attention open to the aliveness that you experience through the sense doors. The sense door of sound, the vibrations. The sense door of touch, and just sensing externally the texture of the air against your skin. Weight of the fabric. The pressure points between your body and the chair or cushion or floor. The sense door of smell. the sense door of sight, this perhaps the perception of light beyond your closed eyes. In your own way, let all the aliveness be in the foreground, fully present. And can you sense, just as you would turn your light, your attention to the light in the movie projector, can you sense the background a quality of alert, awake stillness? You might contemplate this sutta, which is considered the flower of the Dzogchen tradition. It's two lines. Utterly awake, sense doors wide open. Utterly open, non-fixating awareness. And you might just sense when the mind drifts, when it comes back to fixate on a particular sense or a thought form grabs the attention. Is it possible to re-relax? To again open to all the aliveness that you can simultaneously perceive through all the sense doors? And then relax back. Sense this quality of awake stillness. You might now gently deepen your breath. Whatever your experience may be, is it possible to hold this in a quality of non-judging presence? And feel the imprint from this inquiry into sensing both the aliveness of the senses, this relaxing back into the space which holds these changing forms. As you deepen the breath, you feel free to remain with your eyes closed, or if you like, you can let them open. There are so many ways that we can train our attention. From the rigor of concentration to sustaining one pointed attention on an object, to this quality of allowing and opening. You might reflect on these words by a Tibetan teacher. These are part of the conditions that allow us to sense into this quality of true nature. Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is already present in open relaxation and letting go. Do not strain yourself. There is nothing to do or undo. Whatever momentarily arises in the body-mind has no real importance at all, has little reality. Why identify with it, or become attached to it, or pass judgment upon it and ourselves? Better to simply let the entire game happen on its own, springing up and falling back like waves, without changing or manipulating anything. And notice how everything vanishes and reappears, again and again, time without end. Only our searching for happiness prevents us from seeing it. It's like a vivid rainbow which you pursue without ever catching, or a dog chasing its own tail. Do not believe in the reality of good and bad experiences. They're like today's weather, like rainbows in the sky. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As I have kind of immersed myself in more of the practice of concentration and gathering and mindfulness, those words seem quite contradictory to me. If we're applying effort, then what does this mean to simply let go? But there's something here quite powerful about creating the conditions to inquire into our true nature. We must first bring ourselves present. Or as Ram Dass said, you have to be somebody in order to be nobody. It's helpful to know ourselves, to know our stories, to know our behaviors, to see our reactive patterns. All of that is enormously helpful for living skillfully in the world. And yet that very straining, I know for myself that so much of my life of spiritual practice has had a quality of grasping to it. We taste these moments of the mystery. And for me, in a certain form of desperation, I tried to get that back. And I realized that for many, many years of my life as a renunciate, that I was chasing lights and rainbows. That my seeking was actually holding me back from receiving the moment. So it's paradoxical. Ramana Maharshi said this. He talked about the practice of tracking the sense of I am. He said, you are awareness. Awareness is another name for you. Since you are awareness, there is no need to attain or cultivate it. All that you have to do is give up being aware of other things, that is, of the not-self. If one gives up being aware of them, then pure awareness alone remains, and that is the self. so simple. Try that one on. It's pretty powerful. There are ways that we can turn our inquiry in this direction in any time during the day or when we're practicing. When we are aware of sounds, you can ask, who is listening? Or I actually find the phrase, what is listening, to be quite powerful. In the inquiry, you ask the question, and then you simply relax. You relax into what arises. It might be a fraction of a millisecond where the linear mind cannot go. It's an aspect of that quality of falling back. So again, if you'd like to close your eyes, we'll explore another way that we can incline the mind toward this inquiry. You might again let the sense doors open, but in particular, you might let your attention open to sound. So you're narrowing the field of your attention to the direct experience of sound. How intimately can you feel the aliveness of the vibrations of sound? And with the sound in the foreground, can you sense in the background the silence that contains the sound? A quality of alert stillness. You might offer this inquiry and then relax into what arises. What is listening? Gently deepening the breath and just sensing the imprint, the residual effect on mind, body, and presence. This directing from the foreground of aliveness to the sense of the background. What is listening right now? And if you'd like, you can deepen the breath or remain with the eyes closed. As we, from time to time, take that step back to sense the background, there is a quality of non-manipulation, a quality of simply resting and allowing, a deep, deep relaxation. With alertness. So as we turn our attention again and again to this mystery of who we are, as we turn to the formless, there can be sort of a shadow side of almost disassociation, you know, spacing. When, in fact, the practice is actually the opposite. It's about sensing the space, but also intimately attending to the form of what is here. A wonderful reading from Hafez. Once a man came to me and spoke for hours about his great visions of God he felt he was having. He asked me for confirmation, saying, "Are these wondrous experiences true?" I replied, "How many goats do you have?" He looked surprised and he said, "I am speaking of sublime visions and you ask about goats?" And I spoke again, saying, "Yes, brother, how many do you have?" "Well, Hafez, I have 62. "And how many wives?" Again, he looked surprised and he said, "4. "How many rose bushes in your garden? How many children? Are your parents still alive? Do you feed the birds in winter?" And to all he answered. Then I said, "You asked me if I thought your visions were true. I would say that they were if they make you become more human, more kind to every creature and plant that you know." Just as a cloth takes on the color of the dye, so does awareness. When you steep yourself in the space of awareness, you take on the qualities of bodhicitta, an awakened awareness, awakened mind, and awakened heart. The first images of this planet from space perhaps created a shift in our global consciousness. When we could see this planet from space with no boundaries, perhaps there was a shift from, instead of me, more a sense of we. We begin to sense our interconnectedness. Or as Thich Nhat Hanh described, how everything is interconnected or interbeing, our quality of interbeing. There's so many stories of awakened beings who, in their wakefulness, have a capacity, a sensitivity, an awareness of interconnectivity that is simply mind-blowing. There are stories of these Tibetan monks who were imprisoned and tortured. And their intention was not to die, so their captors would not take on that karma. Unfathomable, that capacity for awareness of other, sensitivity of other. So many stories of those who risk their lives for others. A policeman who was reading who, in his attempt to save someone from jumping off a bridge, almost went over with him. And he was asked, "Why did you do it?" And he said, in that moment, his life was as important as mine. That leap of seeing self and other in self. A soldier who throws himself on a hand grenade to protect his best friends in his unit. And that desire that can arise to stand up for those who don't have a voice in our culture. Non-dominant cultures, those that are suppressed. Today is Earth Day. And I am so inspired by those who are rising up to speak for the planet which cannot speak for itself. Where does that come from? That comes from an awakened mind, a sense of our interconnectivity and how important that is. Perhaps we can close with a short reflection and just a few readings. You might let your breath guide your awareness inside once again. And as you open to the space inside your body, you might again just feel or imagine the space inside your lungs as you breathe. Feel or imagine the space inside your body and the space outside your body as one continuous space. And you might imagine from space this spinning planet. All these living beings, those who are coming into form, those who are falling out of form. Sensing both the space and the aliveness of form. And you might sense in this quality of spacious, non-fixating awareness, this quality of the awareness of our interbeing. We'll close with a short meditation on the offering of merit. As you sense this spinning planet with all beings, whatever merit you have generated through your sincere practice, you might first offer it to yourself. Imagine or feel your path opening with a greater sense of ease and well-being. Might be guided by a wise heart. Sensing those in your inner circle, may these beings benefit from the fruit of my practice, offering it freely. And in your own way, imagine that your awareness is so vast that it could envelop this entire planet, this entire ecosystem, all beings, all living things, without exception. In your own way, offer the merit, the benefit of your practice. May all beings feel free, safe, happy, at peace. Thank you so much for your generous listening.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.